On the day my mother left, we participated in a coining ceremony wherein she said goodbye to her fellow eating disorder friends and hello to her family, to us. The coining ceremony was similar to the share circles of group therapy, except that it was solely focused on the patient who was getting out. Everyone read something from their journal about my mother. As I listened, I sensed that within this configuration of fellow patients, my mother was a known entity. She felt cared for and safe, seen. But I was outside the circle. My mother was a stranger to me. My sister was eager to be a part of whatever form my mother was taking on. She melted, molded herself to the dynamic. I didn't want to engage with the illness. The anorexia was what was taking my mother away. I was surprised to find that I was such a focus of the narrative in the room. My mother's desire to be closer to me. My feistiness and anger and alienation, a piece of some puzzle I couldn't see the edges of. Everyone was sobbing, including my father. It was the first time I'd seen him cry. It was like an irrigation system, each person a sprinkler, all watering the room with their tears. I felt drenched, soggy. I wanted everyone to be stronger, to embrace the stoicism I was perfecting. I judged. These weak women and their diseases. Eat already, or stop eating. Get it together. The fragility was suffocating, the dysmorphia so pronounced it made my head hurt. The two-dimensional anorexics and the three-dimensional claymation overeaters. No matter the size of their own sense of insubstantiality, each had taken on the form of her disease. It made me hungry and empty too, but not for food. I was hungry for family, for strength, for wholeness. On the day my mom was released from the hospital, we stopped at a grocery store on the way home. A horrible idea on my father's part, or maybe it was my mom's idea, to show off the cure, a victory lap through the cookie aisle, an acceptance speech in front of the pasta. I don't know if you'd take an alcoholic to a liquor store on the way home from rehab, but maybe it's different with food. The idea was to normalize it, so we tried. I spent the entire grocery store trip telling my mom about the TV show she had missed while she was in the hospital. This was to distract her from the fact that we were surrounded by everything she didn't want to eat. I'd feed her with stories. I'd entertain the pain right out of her. When we got back to the house, there was a sign above the garage door, "Welcome home." I'm certain that when my mother saw it, she wanted to turn right around and go back to the EDU. Who wants to advertise that they are home from the hospital, unless they're bringing home a baby? It was a glaring blitheness on my father's part. Maybe my mom was a newborn, coming home to be loved and nurtured in all the ways that could keep her healthy and in recovery. It was a do-over. The welcome turned out to be temporary anyhow. Within a year, she left for good. Chapter 4. No Normal. One of my earliest childhood memories is my father taking me in the evening to Semana Swim and Recreation Club in Bellevue. It was just him and me. I'd taken swim lessons and could hang out by myself with the help of water wings, goggles, and a kickboard while my father swam laps in a nearby lane. I loved the echo in the cavernous room, the way the sounds and voices melded into each other, gurgling, muted, watercolors for the ears. I spun around, did the dead man's float, watched pale, distorted legs dangle down into the blue. I kept one eye on my dad and another on the pool's edge, my two sources of safety. Too young to get changed in the women's locker room alone, I'd accompany my father to the men's area. Once my clothes were tugged back over my arms and legs, sticky from inadequate toweling off, dampness seeping through in the creases but warm nonetheless, I'd wait for my father to shower and dress. As I sat there, I wasn't looking anywhere in particular, at the rubber mats on the floor, the slats in the bench, at pale toes like gnarled ginger roots, calves with hair worn off in patches from dress socks, and knees everywhere, those scrunched-up featureless faces. "Stop staring," my dad would insist over and over again, sounding admonishing and embarrassed. I kept my head down. Later I realized that this reminder, this reprimand, was likely something my father was saying to himself more than to me, the shame of looking, of wanting to look. And then there was the time we were pulling the car into the garage, and from the back seat I yelled the word penis, for no reason other than that I was 8 years old, and at that age it's fun to call out the words for genitalia in a loud voice. One day I'd come home from kindergarten and repeated a term I'd heard on the playground, "Motherfucker two-ball bitch." Whether it was at my ignorant daring or at the perplexity of the phrase itself, I'm not sure, but my parents laughed. Here I was now going for the encore, But saying penis in front of my father, while he was trapped in a car with me, and thus trapped with that word, and whatever he pictured in his mind when he heard that word, whatever feelings he felt about that word, that thing, resulted in me being dragged upstairs and getting my mouth washed out with soap. Oh, we also received the International Mail Catalog, a men's underwear catalog that is essentially a showcase for big European cocks. Only in retrospect can I find clues to my father's gayness. Sometimes the dull detritus of our past become glaring strands once you realize they form a pattern, a lighted path to the present. I have to turn over and reimagine certain moments from my childhood and make them conform to a different narrative, a different outcome. When my sister and I were both away at college, my father, still living in the house we grew up in, informed us that he was going to start taking in boarders. I imagined something out of a W. Somerset Maugham novel. Doilies, stale biscuits, afternoon tea, a collision of international seekers. Except our house was in the suburbs, carpeted with an open layout, replete with landings and those bulked-up banisters that were good for jumping off when adults weren't around, or for hide-and-seek stealthiness. The playroom, with its sloped ceiling, old striped couch, and first-generation CD player, would be the room for rent. The idea of a boarder seemed odd, even seedy. I was indignant. This was a childhood home, not a hostel. It wasn't for financial reasons. My father's rationale was that the house was unnecessarily big for one person. True. And empty. Also true. I suppose he was staving off loneliness. They were always men or college-aged boys. They were unlike my father. One was a snowboarder with beachy blonde hair whose family owned a water sports business. Another was a part-time musician who sold me an Ampeg amplifier head and cabinet that he was storing in the garage. My garage. One man I know nothing about, save for the fact that his car was repossessed right there in the driveway. If they had one thing in common, it was that all of them were slightly wayward, rough-hewn, jocose. I would occasionally come home on the weekends and no longer feel like the house was a retreat, or even mine. I was simply crashing there like anyone else. There was a new sense of transience to the house, of transition. It was a husk, emptied of sentimentality, populated by strangers. And by that, I don't just mean these men. I also mean my father. I am certain nothing happened between the renters and my dad. The men, the boys, were unaware, in between and on their way. But for my father, this was a rehearsal, a way of circling around a new kind of male intimacy. My father was a corporate lawyer. He went to work in a suit and tie. He had a secretary. He left the house before 7 a.m. His professional life felt generic, like a backdrop, a signifier more than a life. Office job. I knew very little about what he did. He traveled to China, Russia, Australia, sending home postcards and returning with stuffed koala bears or wooden nesting dolls. He collected toy trucks and paraphernalia with company insignia that he displayed atop credenzas or that my sister and I would grudgingly mix in with our other toys, as if we didn't want to sully our Cabbage Patch dolls or My Little Ponies with crass corporate sponsorship. My dad had work friends whom we saw infrequently. It was all trousers and ties, grays and browns. There was a sterility to it that I found both exotic and comforting. The office was in a 1970s high-rise next to a mall, a swift-moving elevator, a destination we reached undeterred, a telephone number I had memorized, a secretary who knew my name. My father wasn't just taciturn. It was like he didn't want to be heard. I don't know if he had nothing to say or if he didn't know what to say. Perhaps his reticence came from not being able to name what or who he was or what he felt. So he stayed quiet and he waited for the words to find him. This is what I know about my father. He grew up in Evanston, Illinois, outside of Chicago. He attended Duke University and then the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for law school. He has one brother. He was the assistant coach of my soccer team and the head coach of my sister's. He ran marathons. He mowed the lawn. He was always working on something called a sump pump in the crawl space. He was slight and handsome, dark-eyed, wide-eyed, wide-nostrilled, looking curious and confounded, boyish. He was stern yet timid, a disciplinarian with no follow-through, self-conscious, not prone to affection, undemonstrative. He liked liver pate. He had a mustache and then he didn't. I cried when he shaved it off because I didn't know he had a space between the bottom of his nose and his upper lip, like a pale secret. My father was hard to know and gave little indication that there was much to know. He claimed he remembered almost nothing about his childhood. He only ever recalled one incident. It was about the first time he came home from college on holiday break. He was sitting in his parents' home, waiting for my grandfather to return from work. When my grandfather came through the door, he greeted the family dog first, even though he and the hound had only been apart for the day and my father had been gone for months. That's the story. My father came out to me in the summer of 1998. I was headed to Seattle from Olympia to pick up a friend at the airport. She wasn't arriving until almost midnight, so the plan was to stop in on my father and then visit some friends after their sound check at the Crocodile Cafe. My father was at his first apartment in Seattle. He had sold the Redmond House, a non-traumatic event, probably for the best considering it had become a house for wayward youth. I was relieved he was out of the suburbs, especially Redmond, changed so fiercely by Microsoft, transformed into a corporate headquarters, indistinguishable from the brand. It was as though you could see an architect's model as you walked around. It had an exemplary quality, both a place and a placeholder. Seattle felt like a good spot for my father. Though he had been living there for a while now, his apartment had that strange first apartment feel, always odd for someone you associate with the accumulation of things. Parents are supposed to be our storage facilities. Insert a memory, let them hold on to it for you. Leave behind stuffed animals and school projects, report cards and clothes. They keep them so you don't have to. I knew that wasn't part of the bargain with my family. I've thrown out piles of things, taken them to the dump and never looked back. But still, to see my dad in a blank space, it only seemed to make him more blurry, like he had just appeared on a canvas before the background was filled in. His sphere was borderless, and the sense of nowhere made me feel alone, unbound. I'd often felt that around my relatives, but now I felt it anew and acutely. Like the first time my dad bought Christmas ornaments, and I realized that after wanting to celebrate Christmas for so long, it wasn't about having a tree. It was about having a box in the basement or attic or garage, something that we could return to over and over again, something that said, this is us, and this is where we were last year, and this is where we'll stay, and this is where we'll pile on memories over and over again until there are so many memories that it's blinding. The brightness of family, the way love and nurturing is like a color you can't name because it's so new. And then my father went out and bought cheap ornaments, and we took them out of boxes and plastic, and I realized it wasn't Christmas that I wanted. What I wanted was a family. So here was my father, in this white apartment with textured walls and thick carpeting and the scant amount of furniture and paintings he'd brought from Redmond, looking like interlopers, like imposters, neither here nor there. And we're sitting in this living room, and I have no idea who he is, and he says, so I guess I'm coming out to you. He said it like that, in a sort of meta way, as if he were along for a ride that his new self was taking him on, which was typical, like he was just a sidekick in his own life, a shadow, though I'm assuming it was more of a linguistic fumbling, not knowing exactly how to come out or what words to use. I was used to this sort of presentational mode at this point. What I heard was, your mother is going into the hospital, or your mother is moving out, or I have cancer. And then again a few years later, I have cancer. I was used to being sat down and presented with life-altering information and taking it with expected nonchalance. This was me asking my friend's parents about MS all over again. My role was to be factual and professional, like a reporter. Emotions were not part of the equation. So tell me, Dad, how did you know? What my father explained next was basically the history of the internet, at least in terms of how we use it for social media and networking. In fact, if it weren't for the internet, I don't know if my father would have realized or been able to acknowledge that he was gay. I thought of Microsoft taking over Redmond, and now gayness taking over my father. He began in chat rooms, international ones, asking questions, talking with other men, many of them married, he made sure to point out. Eventually it was U.S. chat rooms, exchanging stories, feelings, desires, telling of trysts and transgressions, confusion, shame, lust. Eventually he was chatting with other men in Seattle. The truth was a satellite, the picture getting clearer, circling and homing in, and then he was close enough to touch it. He met a male nurse named Russ, a friend, someone he could confide in. And there was a Northwest men's running group. He was allowing the truth to get closer. It was the galaxy at first, then global, then the continent, then local, and finally the shape of him, settling in. I don't know what that must have felt like, to realize you have a body at the age of 55. The year before, my father had been diagnosed with cancer for the second time, kidney. I remember that right before his surgery, he had taken a business trip to Texas. It seemed strange that his company wouldn't send someone else, that he would insist on traveling so close to the surgery. I passed it off as stoicism, not wanting cancer to interrupt his life or schedule, or just denial. But that night in Seattle, he told me that on an earlier trip, he had met a couple in Houston, both lawyers, gay. The trip he took right before his surgery was to come out to them, in case he didn't make it. To strangers, in Texas. He put down a small X on a map, a little scrawl of visibility. Then he came home. The doctors removed the cancer, and he had to live. More important, he wanted to. I took the news better than my sister. She felt abandoned a second time, first my mother and now this. But I too felt confused. If he wasn't himself during my childhood, then what was my childhood? What was I? When someone says, that wasn't me, this is me, then I wonder how was I myself around a you who wasn't. My father had been the constant, the territory, and now I felt like he was rescinding. There was no longer a placeholder. I would have to discover him anew. We want our parents to be the norm from which we deviate. So when my dad came out, my instinct was that I needed to husband up and get married. As if my family wasn't freaky enough. Me, adrift, my sister, unmarried, my mom, ? And now my dad. Who would fly the flag of normality? My sister bore this burden more heavily than I did. But I immediately felt like I should be popping out kids within a few years of my dad realizing he was gay. Let our parents be anorexic and gay. That shit is for teenagers. My sister and I would be the adults. We would be conventional, conservative even. Guns, God, country, and my contrarian, reactionary self. This phase lasted about 10 minutes. When my father came out to his mom, my grandmother said, "You waited for your father to die. Why couldn't you have waited for me to die?" I knew then that I never want to contribute to the corrosiveness of wanting someone to stay hidden. Despite all my initial conflicts about trying to reconcile the father I had as a child to the one I have now, I am thankful that he is happy, that he did not waste another second. Now there is someone to know. Chapter 5. Born Naked. In my junior year of high school, I formed a band with a few girls called Born Naked. We agonized over band names, though clearly not for long enough, until our singer, Alexis, showed up with a naked picture of her mother when she was pregnant, and that was that. We made stickers, which felt more important than the music itself, and practiced at our drummer Rachel's house. Our amps were the size of shoeboxes. Most of our guy friends were in bands. We didn't take ourselves too seriously, almost as a means of warding off any potential criticism. If we thought of Born Naked as a joke, then no one could make fun of us. We were in on it. We got it. Our signature song was one I'd penned called You Annoy Me. Sometimes I think I have barely moved on from that sentiment. So much of my intention with songs is to voice a continual dissatisfaction, or at least to claw my way out of it. The lyrics.
The way you look really annoys me. The way you talk really bores me. You think that you are always right. You keep me awake at night. You're the most annoying person I know. Get out of my life, just go, go, go. Me don't care what you say. We're not listening anyway. So don't talk to me, don't bother me.
The few chords I had learned were courtesy of a neighbor and school friend of mine, Jeremy Enoch, who later became known as the singer and guitarist of the band Sunny Day Real Estate. If I sneaked through a nearby yard, walked up the hill, and down the other side, I could get to Jeremy's adjoining neighborhood. Monikers like Ridgemont East segueing into Hampton Place, indistinct except for the name and the smooth newness of the sidewalks. I carried my guitar without a case, out in the open, both shield and sword. Jeremy was, to quote from a Bikini Kill song, the star-bellied boy of my high school. With an angelic voice, bright eyes pooling with color and sadness, and a preternatural gift for melody, he was our genius. We gathered around him on the bus, at lunchtime, and at parties like he was a messiah. He was floppy-haired, cute, and mysterious, shy and funny. But mostly his appeal was that he could sing. He could take all the records we were listening to, Sinead O'Connor, U2, REM, deliver an up-close version, and bring them into our world. Jeremy became our conduit, taking those formidable albums and making them feel like ours, as if he were a live Walkman we toted around with us, pressing play whenever we wanted to be reminded of our little friend group, how with enough music, with our eyes closed, we could feel like everything and nothing all at once. In Jeremy's bedroom, he'd show me chords by way of playing The Last Day of Our Acquaintance by Sinead O'Connor. I'd play along to the two-chord song while Jeremy sang. Then he'd get bored and start into REM's The One I Love, or U2's New Year's Day, both of which required some arpeggiation, and I'd fumble my way through them, often still on the intro as he played the last note. He was patient with me, encouraging. I'd go home and practice, feeling that even with just a few chords, everything was now in my grasp. At that time, I frequented two record stores, Cellophane Square in the Bellevue Square Mall and Rubato Records, a place owned by an older couple who had played in an early 80s Seattle band called Student Nurse. Rubato was on the first floor of a concrete, two-story office complex in Bellevue. It was there that the clerk recommended I buy two records from a band called Television, not just Marky Moon, but Adventure as well. He asked if I liked Nirvana, to which I answered yes, and he put in my hands the Shocking Blue LP, which featured the original and much more psychedelic version of Love Buzz, a song Nirvana covered on Bleach. If it weren't for Rubato, I wouldn't own Isaac Hayes Records or anything by the Damned. The owners were excited to have an eager and willing explorer, someone whose taste they could influence. Cellophane Square was the more traditional of the two places, with posters on the wall available for purchase that could help demonstrate your music knowledge. 20 years too late, you could display your love for The Clash or Ramones, and I did. Or you could buy a completely unsanctioned Fugazi poster. You could also buy numerous pins or stickers and outfit your jacket or car or notebook with all the outward displays of identity. I drove around the suburbs with a Misfit sticker on my 1979 Honda CVCC, one that referenced their song Bullet about the JFK assassination. The sticker depicted an image of Kennedy getting shot in Dallas, blood pouring from his head, a totally offensive and disrespectful image that I nonetheless hoped would let people know that I considered myself a rebel. These things seemed very important. How else could we identify another weirdo or outlier? These symbols intimated a belief system, a way of thinking not just about music, but about school and friends and politics and society. It was also a way to separate yourself, to feel bold or try on boldness without yet possessing it. A little inkling of the nonconformist person you could be, you wanted to be, but weren't quite ready to commit to. I papered my walls with band posters and what little I could find in mainstream magazines about alternative and punk. Maybe a picture of Babes in Toyland from Spin or Fugazi from Option. The iconoclast images and iconography covered my room, a jarring contrast to the preppy blue and white striped wallpaper I'd insisted on in elementary school. I resented the parts of myself that were late to adopt coolness, late to learn. I wanted to have always possessed a savviness and sophistication, even though I clearly had neither. Born Naked was still in its fledgling stage, a stage from which it would, in fact, never quite fully emerge, when my friend Natalie Cox told me that I should check out what was going on down in Olympia. She thought, rightly, that I might feel a musical kinship with some of the bands coming out of there, Bikini Kill, Bratmobile, Heavens to Betsy, and others. So, though it felt slightly traitorous up in Seattle, I started seeking out K record singles and sending away for the cassettes these Olympia bands were releasing. I bought the 7-inch compilation There's a Dyke in the Pit, which featured the Bikini Kill song Suck My Left One. I also purchased the first eponymous Kill Rockstars compilation that had the Bikini Kill song Feels Blind. I remember being deeply struck by the lyrics. Look what you have taught me. Your world has taught me nothing. And, as a woman, I was taught to always be hungry. We could eat just about anything. We might even eat your hate up like love. To me, that perfectly summed up being a young girl. It was the first time someone put into words my sense of alienation, the feeling that all these institutions and stories we'd been taught to hold as sacred often had very little to do with my own lived experiences. I had already been listening to punk and had related to storytellers like Joe Strummer and Paul Weller, but hearing Bikini Kill was like having someone illuminate my world for the first time. Here was a narrative that I could place myself inside, that I could share with other people to help explain how I felt, especially at a time when I was a shy and fairly inarticulate teen. I could turn the volume up on their songs, and that loudness matched all my panic and fear, anger and emotions that seemed up until that point to be uncontrollable, even amorphous. Bikini Kill's music really gave a form, a home, and a physicality to my teenage turmoil. Eventually, I was able to harness that tumultuousness, build on it, and make it my own. It's hard to express how profound it is to have your experience broadcast back to you for the first time, how shocking it feels to be acknowledged, as if your own sense of realness had only existed before as a concept. I felt like I could step inside something. It was a revelation. More than they influenced my style of playing, Bikini Kill helped to embolden me. I still see music as an act of defiance as much as it is an act of celebration. A lot of my ideas about earning it and owning it come from Bikini Kill's early influence on me. I feel very lucky that Bikini Kill came first. By the time I was playing in Sleater-Kinney, a lot of those early battles for space, for respect, for recognition within the context of punk and indie music had already been fought. We were ultimately recognized as a band, not just as a female band, and that is a luxury that cannot be overstated. A certain kind of exhaustion sets in from having to constantly explain and justify one's existence or participation in an artistic or creative realm. What a privilege it must be to never have to answer the question, how does it feel to be a woman playing music? Or, why did you choose to be in an all-female band? The people who get there early have to work the hardest. Bikini Kill weren't the first. They had predecessors and influences, but they carved, tore, and clawed out a space in music for which I am very grateful. I had started running away from home in high school. Nothing dramatic. Simply leaving for a few days with no intention to return. Sometimes I told my father, other times I did not. Late at night, I'd put the car in neutral and push it out of the garage with the engine off. Halfway down the driveway, I'd start the motor. My moods and my whereabouts went undetected for the most part. And I think in part that is why I didn't want to be around. I felt unseen and thus sought out visibility elsewhere. I took comfort in the families of various friends. I was appreciative of the attention they gave me, the kindness. I spent Easter with one friend by default, as I had spent Saturday night at her house and woke up to the Sunday holiday. For my best friend Katie's mother, I did chores. I vacuumed and dusted. I loved how normal these lives felt so much that I was willing to perform tasks I would only do for my father after much resistance. I watched movies and sat around dinner tables, discussing art and politics, inserting myself into conversations and dynamics so that I could sense what it might feel like to be held accountable, to be required to show up. I practiced being a daughter, a sister, someone who had a role in traditions. I existed half in my own family and half in others. I was such a frequent resident at Katie's house that her mom asked my father if I would switch to a private school senior year. She feared Katie wouldn't go otherwise. I applied and got in. I felt like no one was really looking out for me, that I was marginal and incidental. I compensated by being sponge-like, impressionable, and available to whatever and whoever provided the most comfort, the most sense of belonging. I was learning two sets of skills simultaneously. Adaptation, linguistic and aesthetic, in order to fit in, but also how to survive on my own. When it came to applying to college, discussing the options with my father, it all took on a desultory shape. Despite my being accepted at Lewis and Clark, it turned out we couldn't afford it. I was stuck with my backup choice. I really didn't want to go to Western Washington University. I had no plan, and I left for the northern part of the state knowing only that I would not be there for long, departing for a departure. Nevertheless, I went through the motions. I set up my dorm room inside a building that resembled a travel lodge, entrances on the outside, concrete, unglamorous, and institutional. My favorite thing about Western was the meal card, a fact that began to show up on my increasingly rounded cheeks. Perhaps it was my lack of commitment that prevented me from making friends. I spent my days listening to records and trying to ingratiate myself to a roommate named Amy who had grown up in Olympia. In my vision of Olympia, it was mythical. It was Paris or Berlin in the 20s. It was the Bloomsbury Group. It was the cradle of civilization. I sensed Olympia would be my salvation, where I needed to end up. It was also tiny. I assumed that every denizen of that town was a young punk, walking around with a bag full of 7-inch shingles and a fanzine, and in a band. But Amy had never heard of these bands from Olympia, so she graciously let me proselytize to her about her own hometown, a town she was likely relieved to have departed, off to bigger and better things. I regaled her with tales of indie labels. I played her Heavens to Betsy and Bikini Kill cassettes and KRS compilations. She tried to be helpful, filling in geographical gaps in my knowledge while I filled in musical ones in hers. Amy became an ersatz lifeline for me, a temporary and tenuous pathway to where I wanted to go. It was a pitiful and one-sided friendship, and one I probably remember with more fondness and importance than she ever will. She was a placeholder for me, just some unwitting kid from Olympia who would serve as a stand-in for my dreams and aspirations. I went to a show in the cafeteria where a local band played a cover of the Go-Go's Our Lips Are Sealed. I remember seeing the guitarist walk around campus the next day, and I was filled with wonder. I wanted to be someone who had that power to drift in and out of people's imaginations, who could be bigger than mere human form, a surface upon which others could project their longings. I needed other people's outward manifestations of self to help me realize who I could be. A girl at Western named Andy, lumbering and slouched, but way more motivated and less self-conscious than I was, immediately got involved in the radio station, wanting to bring bands to the school. In that fall of 1992, she brought Mudhoney to Western. We learned that there was going to be a surprise guest, and that the guest would be Nirvana. They would open the show. When Nirvana took the stage, they played in front of an audience that didn't really expect or deserve their presence, which was probably all they had hoped for at that moment. I, of course, completely took for granted the fact that they likely felt lucky they could still surprise anyone, that they could sneak onto a stage and play a normal show, that they could open for friends in a small college town in their home state, that they could pretend to still just be some normal guys. I took for granted that set, the ease and exuberance of it. They played mostly off Nevermind, just three people with the best songs you've ever heard, scrappy and guttural and really loud. And as openers for Mudhoney, you could really hear the context from which all this was happening. Chainsaws making sonic carvings, hollowed-out selves amplified and discordant. There was some thread of sweetness underneath, a melodic sense that hit you in the back of the throat and made you want to raise up a weary, tentative fist, hoping that gesture would mark you as having been found, or ready to no longer feel lost. And even though it was Nirvana, playing a secret show at my school, the best musical moment at my time at Western was yet to come. Flyers went up for Bikini Kill, Heavens to Betsy, and Mechanormal. The three bands were coming to play at the Show-Off Gallery in downtown Bellingham. I had been listening to Heavens to Betsy every day. They had a six-song cassette that intrigued me in a way nothing before had. It was a combination of Corin Tucker's voice and the lyrics. The beautiful parts were edged in disgrace and disgust. It bordered right on ugly the whole time. The singing was louder than it needed to be. Did she even need a mic? The music was rudimentary, the drums like an uneven stagger, a determined but ungraceful late-night walk home, the guitar or bass playing just a pattern that repeated until it was an incision. But it was the voice that really cut through. The voice asked to be listened to, but it did not beg or plead. It dared and challenged. It confronted, but needed no reply from the listener. Any sadness was also defiant. It was not the wail of mourning, but of murder. And there was so much I wanted to destroy. I went to the Heavens to Betsy show with Amy. A sign on the door announced that Bikini Kill had canceled on account of a family illness. It didn't matter. I'd still see Heavens to Betsy. The Los Angeles Times had sent a reporter and a photographer to cover the show. At the time, Riot Girl was a movement that the mainstream press was desperate to understand. News outlets continually attempted to infiltrate the underground, never to really get a handle on it, only serving to mischaracterize its impact. Heavens to Betsy was a wolf in sheep's clothing, two small women who took up very little physical space on a stage. Typically, when a two-person band performs live, they find ways of compensating for their diminutive population via aesthetic amplification and augmentation. They surround themselves with a cityscape of amplifiers. They use drum risers and lighting to create formidable shadows, a landscape of giants. They find ways to add a sense of largeness. But Corin had only her handmade guitar that her father had helped build. It was a crude piece of machinery painted matte black, and it looked like a home appliance that had been melted down in a fire. And she played with the tiniest of amps, an orange Roland cube with one speaker, the entire thing the size of a carry-on suitcase. No pedals, no tuner. She was accompanied by Tracy Sawyer, the drummer and occasional bass player Corin had dragged along with her to Olympia from their childhood hometown of Eugene, Oregon. Tracy backed up Corin tentatively but proudly, stubbornly, the way a younger sibling would, with a secret and shy courage. The noise they made in Heavens to Betsy was vicious and strange. It completely changed one's notion of what it meant to be powerful on stage. It was not about strength in numbers nor in size. It had nothing to do with volume. It was about surprise. It was about knowing you were going to be underestimated by everyone and then punishing them for those very thoughts. They took themselves seriously, too. It was a strident show. Eventually, Korn was able to bring her sense of humor about the world and about herself into her music. But when you're part of an early movement, like she was with Riot Girl, where she had to create a space for herself and for her audience, where every show felt like a statement, where before you could play and sing, you had to construct a room, one you'd be respected in, wouldn't get hurt in, a space that allowed for or even acknowledged stories that hadn't been told before, about sexual assault, sexism, homophobia, and racism, and then musically, you have to tear that very space down. There's not a lot of room for joking around. There's a direness in the construction of safety, in the telling of theretofore untold stories. I was really intimidated by those Heavens to Betsy shows. I thought, these people are so cool and so not funny. I knew not to kid around or make some crass, sarcastic comment because, well, these people will fuck you up. Heavens to Betsy came across as the most serious of their peers. You stood up, you listened, and you were quiet. They were like really loud librarians. And as the audience, you better shut the hell up because you're in the library of rock right now. When Heavens to Betsy finished their set, I walked up to Corin. I told her I wanted to drop out of Western and move to Olympia. She said I should do that, and soon. It felt like an order. She had a spiral notebook, and I wrote down my address and told her to keep in touch. Knowing my days in Bellingham were numbered, especially now that my departure had been ordained by the singer I admired, I gave her my father's address back in Redmond. Now I had to leave. What if Korn reached out to me and I wasn't there to receive her beck and call? My first real band, Excuse 17, would eventually tour the United States with Heavens to Betsy. The audiences were very earnest. And due to the political nature of Heavens to Betsy, it felt like a real dialogue between band and audience, almost like they were bringing a lecture into town. After the shows, Korn would spend a lot of time talking to audience members about issues or even objections they had with her music, or with certain lyrics, or with punk or indie music in general. I'd see someone finger-pointing, and I would be annoyed for her, but Korn would always be grateful for the interaction. For me, that tour, the music, the whole punk scene felt very made up as it went along. There was a malleability to it as we vacillated between, experimented with, or claimed identities. If someone didn't feel included, if someone felt marginalized, they would form their own band, write their own fanzine, or just call you out on what they deemed racist or classist, sizist, sexist, body ableist. For a movement that professed to grant one a sense of belonging and solidarity, we are often made aware of our differences. In the span of a single show, or in the reading of a fanzine or the lyric sheet of an album, one's own experiences could be publicly validated in one instant and then invalidated the very next. There was a real power struggle to find a coalescence and to acknowledge commonalities in our disparities. We wanted to protect one another, to be inoffensive, inclusive, aware of our own shortcomings and faults, to improve and evolve, to make radical changes. Yet there was so much pressure on the single indie and punk movement, one that clearly couldn't address all forms of personhood or inequality. I should acknowledge that I am so grateful for Korin, who, coming up through Riot Girl, was never afraid to be unpopular in her beliefs, who worried so little about what others thought. Because of her, I could applaud from the sidelines. I could apply my own analysis to the situation from a safe distance. In our years writing songs together, Korin could make the mess, and I could figure out what it meant and what significance it held. It was a good balance. She was plain-spoken and trenchant. She could write lyrics to dig me out, and those three words could tell you everything you needed to know about the feeling of smallness, of being held back, of such a basic desire to tear even a fraction of light into any form of darkness we're dealt with. I could grapple with titles like Wilderness or Moonless for our seventh record, and Korin could just say, "What about the woods?" And that was that. The woods, of course. It doesn't merely describe something. It is something. When I dropped out of Western and moved back home with my father, he seemed certain I had ruined my life, that I'd never go back to college, have a job, or amount to anything. He was flummoxed by my indecision and lack of drive. I, on the other hand, was ready to test whether my increasingly thorny disposition could puncture the soft padding of my suburban environs. One catch to that plan, a cliché one no less, was that I still needed my dad's help. Like a lot of middle-class kids, I needed my punk rock and rebellion underwritten by my parents. I wanted to go to Evergreen State College, not so much to study as to have a valid excuse to be in Olympia. My father agreed to let me live at home as long as I left for college in the fall as planned. The interim was difficult. I worked my first real jobs. One was for a catering company that delivered meals to office parks. I'd wheel a cooler full of salads and sandwiches that had been prepared in the wee hours of the morning in a nondescript warehouse into an office lobby, where the receptionist would make an announcement over the PA, "Deli girl is here!" Who was this deli girl to whom she was referring? Oh, it was me. I figured out a way of manipulating the numbers so that I could take a chicken salad and a piece of lemon pound cake home at the end of the day. It was a tiny, ineffectual fuck you to the man. The woman who trained me had a perky sales routine that she passed on to me in order to boost my numbers. She also suggested I remove my nose ring, or at the very least clean it on occasion. She'd tell her customers that she had some pound cake here and here, pointing at each of her thighs. I laughed at the middle-aged lady aspect of it until I myself gained 10 pounds and was humbled by being college-aged, but clearly not in school. Here I was delivering meals on wheels to people my age who were already working their way up the corporate ladder. And even though I had never imagined myself on the corporate ladder, I had also never pictured myself peddling tuna fish on sourdough to those who were. So I quit. Next, I got a job in telemarketing. I worked for a company that helped college kids get summer jobs on cruise ships or fishing up in Alaska. They didn't actually help anyone get anything. They simply sold a book with a list of phone numbers and addresses. I was pretty great at reading the script into the phone, deviating from it only enough to add my own flair and personal charm. I was making $10 an hour and got promoted to the mailroom. There I gave myself daily paper cuts that I used as reminders, witchy whispers to myself, letting me know this was only temporary. What I wanted was to play music. My friend Jana, whom I had met in a high school chemistry class and who had played bass and Born Naked, was now at the University of Washington. She and I would go out on band auditions, separately or together, showing up at houses where purple-haired punks took us to their basement and we'd run through Agent Orange songs. Bloodstains. I never felt scared for my life, only nervous not to play well, self-conscious about my youth and that my preppiness would show through. Everyone wanted to have a girl punk band, especially with L7, Hole, 7-Year Bitch, Luna Chicks, and Bikini Kill all getting attention. I auditioned for a band called Not My Son, which pretty much sums up the moniker trend of the time. In high school, I had jammed with guys and had been doing a fair bit of auditioning for bands that were co-ed, but I was more excited about the Olympia scene and its kin. About Heavens to Betsy and Broutmobile, about Tiger Trap and Autoclave, about bands like Crevice with 8 girls in it, about Slant 6. I wanted to have a girl gang. Jana and I would place musician wanted ads in The Rocket, Seattle's Music Weekly. We were searching for a drummer and a singer. People would reply to the ad, and we would go to their houses to audition them. I don't know why we didn't make people come to us. Perhaps because we didn't have a drum kit. But it felt like we were enacting some strange variation of the traveling salesman. We would bring our amps and our guitars and set up in strangers' basements or living rooms, unloading our wares and doing a musical sales pitch. Arriving at each house was the ultimate blind date. No pictures had been exchanged, no MP3s sent over the computer. It was often obvious the second the woman would answer the door that we didn't have mutual taste in music. Despite this, there was a hopefulness to the process. I'd think, "You only like the Indigo Girls and you have your old dreadlock taped to the wall. But we're both women, so this should work out just fine." There was, for example, the carton of cigarettes a day couple with the husband acting as a proud stage dad, talking up his wife the whole time. The woman was about 20 years older than us, worn in skin with bleached hair, gray roots on display. She was squat and tough, a 4x4 of a human. She sang her heart out over our rudimentary 3-chord song, channeling Janis Joplin and Ann Wilson, with a croak and ache of experience that we were years from knowing. Her husband stood next to her during the entire audition, president of a one-person fan club, rooting for her and his big break, as if two kids from the suburbs, more Bert and Ernie than Lennon and McCartney, were going to take this woman to the top of the charts. We were so often mismatched. The tryouts were a heartbreaking and humbling experience. Every audition was American Idol in miniature, dreamers meeting up with other dreamers, pinning our hopes on the least likely, yet always undeterred. Even then, I could still appreciate the moment of simply making sounds with a group of people. There is another place you go to in those instances, and it feels vast, refreshing, like you're creating your own air to breathe. And even though it's never going to happen again, and there's a palpable sense of mediocrity, there's still a connection that you wouldn't have otherwise, to the sound, to the people. I think for those reasons, I've always been able to appreciate, but be simultaneously heartbroken by, bar bands and karaoke. You witness the playing or the singing and you know that just being up there, engaged in a momentary artifice, a heightening of self, is sometimes enough to get by, to feel less worn down by, less withered by life. Sometimes it's everything. Seven-Year Bitch, a rock band of all women, were the heroines of the Seattle scene in the 90s. They were equally as tough as the rock dudes, and they seemed like they partied just as hard. Seven-Year Bitch's music was fierce and growly, and their onstage personas, in particular lead singer Celine Vigil's, were as amped as their songs. They weren't as catchy or punk-based as their Olympia counterparts, but I felt an affinity with them because of their geographical proximity to me, like I owed them that loyalty. They exemplified the Seattle sound of the era. Their songs had a rough, unadorned quality, as if they were scraped from tree bark. Stephanie Sargent, their young and talented guitarist, had recently died of a heroin overdose. I had no relationship with drugs, nor any idea how one could journey down a dark path only to dig further into blackness. When she overdosed in 1992, the year I had graduated from high school, her death felt like a distant, imperceptible loss, a hollowing that only later I realized would grow each time a musician died. One week, scanning the Rocket as I always did, searching for a band to join, for an ally across the bridge in Seattle, for some way out of Redmond, I came across an ad that simply read, "Girl guitarist wanted, no wanky solos." That is me, I thought. After all, I don't even know how to play a solo, let alone a wanky one. I called the number, and Elizabeth Davis from Seven-Year Bitch answered. I couldn't believe someone who I thought was fairly famous would be placing an ad in a local paper, that she could just be a normal person on the other end of the line. I shook and talked too fast and laughed when there weren't any jokes. Here's how I remember it. I'm lying on my twin bed in my dad's house on some highly flammable two-tone comforter. Elizabeth. You play guitar? Carrie. Yes. Elizabeth. It's raining out. Carrie, I know. I was hysterical. I told her I loved Seven-Year Bitch, and then I rattled off a bunch of Olympia bands that I liked. Bikini Kill, Bratmobile, Beat Happening, until I worried that I sounded too biased toward the town south of us, and then I heard the word Soundgarden come out of my mouth. I offered to learn their songs and come over to audition. For the next 2 days, I sat in my room listening to their Lorna 7-inch over and over, memorizing the parts, already imagining myself up on stage, on tour, with a new life and new friends. Learning a song from a 7-inch is not easy. There is no pausing, no replay, just picking up and putting down the needle again and again. I drove with Katie, my best friend from high school, and my Honda CVCC. It was a Death on Wheels clown car, blueberry round, stick shift, seats covered in lamb's wool, updated with an Alpine stereo. We went over the 520 bridge to Seattle and into the Queen Anne neighborhood where Elizabeth lived. My outfit was a classic suburban impersonation of a more urbane look. Cut-off jeans with a slight pleat at the top, paired with an oversized Hanes t-shirt I took from my dad's dresser. I also wore one of my father's suit vests, which swung out from my body like saloon doors. Worst of all was that I had a green J. Crew baseball cap atop my head that I inexplicably wore backward. In a momentary fit of self-consciousness and doubt, and I am relieved that I can write this, I removed the hat before I got out of the car. I was 18. Katie waited in the parking lot. I brought my guitar in with me in case Elizabeth might want to spontaneously jam or wanted a more formal audition. Elizabeth answered the door in something black, a color so obvious and easy, a shorthand for cool. Why hadn't I thought to wear black? I looked clean-cut in comparison, and like I might be there to deliver pizza or ask her to save the whales. I was then offered a beer. It was midday. I was at the age where I only drank to get drunk, and alcohol was something I still snuck from my dad, usually a blend of 5 different alcohols skimmed from the liquor cabinet and then diluted with Coke inside a giant plastic cup from a fast food restaurant giveaway. Sitting around sipping a beer in the daylight felt wrong, and I wasn't even sure I liked beer if it wasn't being poured down my throat, circumventing my taste buds via beer bong. I sank into the couch, which only made me feel smaller and even less capable. Elizabeth talked a little about Stephanie and the day of the funeral. It was odd to be privy to what I considered a private matter, or a public one that I'd only read about in the papers, the death of a friend, a bandmate. I felt grown up to be considered a temporary confidant, but immature in the way I couldn't wait to tell my friends. Then the singer Celine came over. This felt promising. I was being checked out, examined. Celine had a raspy voice and was all muscle shirt and sinew and messed up hair. Suddenly, my oversized t-shirt seemed even bigger and whiter. There I was, a puffy cloud on a couch, surrounded by women who were so clearly thunder and lightning, and I wasn't even drinking a beer. I left knowing that they would never ask me to be in Seven Year Bitch. Yet in my youthful ignorance and optimism, I was determined to stay positive. I felt hopeful. That hope was quickly diminished when Elizabeth called me the next day and told me it wasn't going to work. She said I was too young and that the band played a lot of bar shows. I still didn't want to give up or let go. It didn't seem fair. I felt like this might be my only chance to be in a band, a real band. So I did what any teenage girl would do. I wrote a letter wherein I compared myself to the Red Hot Chili Peppers guitarist John Frusciante. Frusciante had joined the Chili Peppers when he was 18 or 19, and even though he was a genius guitar player, a true wunderkind, and I only knew a couple of chords, I felt like the comparison just might work. Not only was I likening myself to a virtuoso guitarist, but I was also displaying gumption and guts. At least that's what I thought. I would charm my way into this band, if not with my J. Crew outfits, then with my savvy. Unfortunately, I didn't end the letter there. Instead, I bared my soul. As in the letters I had written to soap stars and teenage heartthrobs in elementary school and junior high, I told Elizabeth about my entire life, how I didn't get along with my parents, about my mom leaving, the whole maudlin story. People think that the digital age and social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter nurture oversharing, but in 1992 there was nothing stopping me from treating any piece of paper like a personal diary. I wanted so badly to be taken to some special place, to be asked into a secret club that would transform my life. I felt like music was that club, and to see inside for a moment and then be asked to leave was devastating. During the next few months, I occasionally ran into Elizabeth at Seattle shows and music festivals like 1077's N-Fest. She was always kind to me, but I had clearly become a pest. Later, when I knew what it felt like to carry the weight of your fans' aspirations, I would remember the way Elizabeth looked at me after I'd sent the letter, a look of pity, distrust, and weariness. There's a gulf of misunderstanding between musicians and their fans, and often so much desperation that the musician can't possibly assuage, rectify, or heal. You feel helpless and you feel guilty. With Slater Kinney fans, I tried to be generous, but I soon grew uneasy. For a long while, I could share nothing more than the music itself. I think I was too scared to be open with the fans because I knew how bottomless their need could be. How could I help if I was just like them? I was afraid I might not be able to lessen their pain or live up to their ideals. I would be revealed as a fraud, unworthy and insubstantial. The disconnect between who I was on and off stage would be so pronounced as to be jarring. Me, so small, so unqualified. In the early years of Slater Kinney, we played at Seattle's Crocodile Cafe. Elizabeth was at the show. By then, Seven Year Bitch had broken up. She came up to me, complimented my guitar playing, and told me she loved the band. Elizabeth didn't recognize me as the girl who had gone over to her house that day or written her an overly earnest tell-all letter. I was relieved that music had done exactly what I had always wanted it to do, which was turn me into someone else. Jana and I had mostly given up on finding bandmates via classified ads. One night the Breeders were playing in Olympia at the Capitol Theater, so Jana and I drove down. We stood in the orchestra pit, crammed up against other kids, giddy with anticipation, wrapped up in that collective swell of appreciation and adoration. In front of us stood a group of girls with baby bangs and barrettes, yellow or black or red hair, and vintage glasses. Jana and I were awkward. She was nearly 6 feet tall, with shaggy curls that she habitually tucked behind her ears with a bashful shrug. I had manic panic magenta hair and big cheeks, a nose ring that was constantly on the verge of infection, a thrift store t-shirt from the boys' section paired with corduroys cut off at the bottom with scissors, no seam, frayed. We weren't exactly cool. We started talking to these girls and found out they lived in Seattle, a boon for us since befriending a bunch of Olympia kids would mean yet another thing that was out of our reach. By the end of the night, after singing along and matching Kim and Kelly Deal grin for grin, we had the phone numbers of Polly, Jilly, and Rachel. It was early 1993, and I was floundering. My telemarketing office was in the University District near another branch of Cellophane Square, the record store I loved, and a guitar shop I could gawk at. Most of my work conversations consisted of people bragging that a friend of a friend knew the drummer in the Pixies, or had lived in the same town as the singer from Toad the Wet Sprocket. I offered to be in a band with a cute and hip-looking woman who I admired for her ability to pull off overalls, but she wasn't interested. I ate lunch in my car. So meeting Polly, Jilly, and Rachel could not have come in a better time. It gave me a sense of purpose. It was inspiring. It was something to do, somewhere to go. Mostly, Jana and I and the rest of the girls hung out at Polly's. She was living with her mom in the Wedgwood neighborhood of Seattle. Their house was small, underlit, cozily cluttered. We'd hang out what seemed like every night, dye each other's hair, put on makeup, listen to records, watch late-night music videos, get drunk, draw a lie around. It was languid, shapeless, and very sweet. One night, after we'd all been hanging out for a few weeks, we were drinking some kind of saccharine liqueur, something you'd only drink if it were free, free as in stolen from one's parents. The flavor made for a woozy, treacly buzz. Polly suggested that we pass the drink mouth to mouth. It started like that, our mouths merely conduits, containers. The feeling was warm, but still perfunctory. But somewhere in the middle of this contrived routine, this newfound alcohol dispensing technique, was an ersatz kiss, another mouth. Soon I was centering in on the sensation of the place where the lips touched to see whether it felt good. And then the alcohol became secondary to skin. And then there was just kissing. It lasted hours. An expedition. It didn't feel revelatory, but it also didn't feel strange. I woke up the next morning in my childhood bed and called Jana. She felt sick, horrified. For her, it had been an awakening, and she wanted to die. I was shut off from my body. I had barely thought about sexuality or longing. Up until this point, my sexual experiences had felt businesslike or even transactional. A trade agreement with a neighbor, wherein I'd give him a blowjob and then later get something in return. That something never happened, by the way, though I'm certain I didn't miss much. There was a party in high school where I spent the last hour essentially making out with the pimply back of a guy's neck who was sitting in front of me on the floor. I was too afraid to ask for more, or even suggest that he turn around. With female friends, I'd cuddled at sleepovers, but never touched or reached out in any sort of romantic way. I hadn't been suppressing urges or denying my needs. I didn't feel like I had any, not corporeal ones. My journal entries from that time speak to depression and feelings of isolation, fears that a friend would leave, a sense that I had been responsible for my mother's departure and would therefore cause anyone I loved or needed to leave. I was still spending most of my time in my head. I was removed from my own feelings. Like so many aspects of my life up until that point, the only remarkable thing about that night was that it was a small version of letting go, which I sort of detested and definitely feared. The marathon makeout did bring to light that living with my dad and sister was proving problematic. In the brief time I had been in Bellingham, the two of them had somehow turned into bros more than anything resembling father and daughter. My sister's room was decorated with European beer bottles, and a lazy boy was now parked in front of our living room TV. Stacy was mysteriously allowed to throw parties, and my dad's only social life seemed to revolve around her soccer games. I moved out of Redmond and into a cheap apartment in Seattle's Capitol Hill. Now with all of us in the city, the five of us formed a band that we called Conspiracy A-Go-Go. We practiced in the basement and recorded a four-track cassette tape so we could get a handful of shows in small bars. Okay, in the corner of small bars, on a carpeted floor, during the day. Also, a handful might be an exaggeration. We weren't very good. None of us could really sing, and the songwriting was rudimentary, but not in a charming, purposely minimalist way. We didn't care that we were the musical version of a stick figure. It was more about feeling like we were doing something. It was a way of being around one another. By now, the band consisted of two pseudo-couples and a fifth wheel. Pseudo, meaning none of us would really admit to what was happening. We were like Fleetwood Mac, without the sex, or drugs, or hair, or songs. Polly was friends with Calvin Johnson of K Records, so we got a show opening up for the sub-pop band Codeine down in Olympia. This excruciating experience was how I learned about onstage sound and audio. I think people take for granted that there's any sort of manual for playing live. On this night, the first time I got on stage, a real stage, I had never used a proper PA or had anything other than the vocals mic'd. There was a speaker in front of me, a monitor, it turned out. But I had no idea that I would need to ask to get specific instruments in there. And for that matter, I didn't know what to even ask for, what would be important for me to hear to enable me to play the songs the way I knew them and to which I was accustomed. I had no idea that if I didn't get certain instruments in the monitor, I wouldn't be able to hear the other band members, that everything I knew about our songs would be dismantled and